It's my very great pleasure this evening to welcome you here to the Anna Freud Center and to introduce you to Sarah Churchwell. It's doubly a pleasure because Marilyn Monroe actually came to what is now the Freud Museum, Freud's house, to see Anna Freud when she was filming The Prince and the Showgirl. And because of that, there's been a long association between Anna Freud, who recommended her American analyst to her, and Marilyn Monroe. Now, Sarah looks the part, so doesn't need much introduction. Sarah is what Marilyn might have wanted to have been, which is a professor of American literature and the public understanding of the humanities at the University of East Anglia. She's also the author of this fabulous book called The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe, which is primarily why she's here tonight. She's also the author of Careless People, which is a wonderful study of the making of The Great Gatsby. Now, as some of you will know, Zelda Fitzgerald also had some implication in this whole business of what this building is dedicated to, and indeed Freud's house, which is the caring for people with some forms of mental distress. We won't diagnose anything here. It's my very, very good pleasure to turn you over to Sarah, who you know from television appearances, on the review program, and much more. Sarah,
thank you.
Over to you.
And thank you for the invitation, and thank you all for coming and for putting up with the microphone.
I didn't say one thing, which is that Sarah has specially brought this book, which is now out of print. Is it out of print, or is it waiting to come back
It's in between prints in the UK. It's in print in the US.
Okay, but, so in between, but she has brought us a few copies. So for those of you who would like to buy it straight after, she will sign it and dedicate it specially.
Happily, thank you. So yes, as Lisa said, I thought I'd begin with Marilyn's connection to this very place where we've come together tonight. It seems to be the case that Marilyn Monroe visited this house in the summer of 1956 for a session or sessions with Anna Freud. Marilyn was in London filming The Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier, having married Arthur Miller just weeks previously. The film, her first with her own production company, was supposed to represent a triumph. For 5 years and more, Monroe had been battling her studio, 20th Century Fox, that saw her as nothing but a dumb blonde and cast her in roles that, for the most part, made the studio head's contempt for her clear. If there was one thing Marilyn Monroe was not, it was a dumb blonde. She was neither dumb nor a blonde. But she had almost no formal education, a traumatically insecure childhood, and had traded her most obvious asset, which was not simply her remarkable beauty and sexual allure, but these qualities' unusual responsiveness to being photographed, into what power she had. Between 1952 and 1956, she went from being a starlet, that diminutive, diminishing term, to being the biggest movie star in the world. But she was paid a fraction of the money paid to her co-stars, fought to be given decent roles of any kind of range or intelligence, and listened with mounting anxiety and rage to the derision heaped upon her by a nation that claimed it loved her. At the end of 1955, fed up with battling Daryl Zanuck and other executives at Fox Studios, and determined to prove to a sneering, leering media and press corps that she was more than just a pretty face and a body, she enrolled at Lee Strasberg's Actors Studio, the preeminent acting school of the day, which had famously trained Marlon Brando, Paul Newman, James Dean, and Montgomery Clift. It had also trained some women, but they always seemed to count less. Strasberg ran his acting workshops like group therapy sessions and famously insisted that all his students begin psychoanalysis. Ilya Kazan said that Strasberg promoted, quote, glassy-eyed psychological posturing, and many have said that that Strasberg encouraged students to present their own emotional response rather than the characters. With Strasberg's encouragement, Marilyn began to see Dr. Margaret Hohenberg, a renowned Viennese analyst in New York. Certainly, Marilyn's painful, precarious childhood had left her a legacy of mental distress, serious demons of insecurity with which to grapple. She never knew her father, and when Marilyn was 8, her mother was institutionalized, diagnosed as a schizophrenic, a diagnosis now disputed, but as far as Marilyn Monroe ever knew, an accurate one, leaving her with an understandable terror of inheriting her mother's madness. This legacy never leaves her story, and the presumption that Marilyn Monroe was mad defines many of her biographies and much of her cultural construction. Anthony Summers opens his biography of Marilyn Monroe, for example, which is called Goddess, which tells you, gives you a sense of where he's going, by warning the reader never to believe Marilyn's own words. Quote, "We must treat what she tells us with informed skepticism. Marilyn, an international fantasy figure, constructed her image, both public and private, from a blend of fact and self-serving fantasy." I love that one, as if she's really to blame for self-serving fantasies if the rest of us have altruistic fantasies. Self-serving fantasies. "She exercised to excess a common human license. Fantasy was part of this creature, and part of the challenge is to discover the woman who sheltered behind it." By the end of the book, Summers is paraphrasing Monroe's psychiatrist, asserting that she was psychotic, quote, "a candidate for an institution." The question of hereditary insanity is nearly as fraught as that of Monroe's paternity, which is a question that biographers spend reams of pages dwelling on, and I can talk about in questions if you're interested in, since it's not really my topic today. Not coincidentally, insanity is like illegitimacy in being a question laden with cultural value. Mental illness, of course, continues to bear a stigma, while implying for some people a lack of discipline and excessiveness with which Marilyn is always associated. More obviously, madness has been linked with female sexuality since at least the Middle Ages, which I'm sure I don't need to tell anybody here. Marilyn's reputed insanity adds the finishing touches to the melodrama of her life, making it read like a Victorian novel. Gladys Monroe, Marilyn's mother, was diagnosed, as I said, as paranoid schizophrenic by her doctors, but biographers nonetheless continue to argue about what precisely her illness was. There are a couple of reasons for this dispute, but one of them is a common confusion about what schizophrenia actually means as a clinical psychiatric disorder. As I'm sure, again, you know, but just in case there's any lingering confusion about this, to be clear, psychiatry does not use schizophrenia to denote split or multiple personality, which psychiatry today terms dissociative identity disorder, or DID. This frequent mistake leads to arguments like the one S. Paige Beatty advances, and she's a scholar, so she should know better, in her book American Monroe, that the proliferation of images of Marilyn Monroe is a sign of postmodern, quote, cultural schizophrenia, in which, quote, hosts of real, final, and true Marilyns are reproduced in various media, each version claiming to most realistically reassemble the star. Beatty's confusion of schizophrenia with multiple or dissociated personalities lets her read Monroe's own life as an example of such cultural schizophrenia, a reading dependent upon Beatty's mistakenly literal interpretation of Monroe's mother's diagnosis. Beatty declares that Monroe herself, quote, suffered from mental illness all her life. But although Marilyn was clearly unhappy, even desperate, it is by no means unanimously agreed that Monroe suffered from clinical mental illness as distinct from the damage caused by her undisputed addiction to drugs. The confusion with split personality derives, of course, from the etymology of the term schizophrenia, which translates as split mind. Psychiatry uses it figuratively, whereas in common practice, it is understood literally. And this literalism becomes itself a pathology in the cultural construction of Marilyn Monroe. In her study of femininity and insanity, the female malady, Elaine Showalter suggests the way in which schizophrenia came to dominate discussions of female madness in the middle of the 20th century. Quote, "Schizophrenia offers a remarkable example of the cultural conflation of femininity and insanity. First of all, unlike hysteria, anorexia nervosa, or depression, schizophrenia is not a predominantly female disorder. Most studies seem to show that the incidence is about equal in women and men. Nevertheless, the schizophrenic woman has become as central a cultural figure for the 20th century as the hysteric was for the 19th. Modernist literary movements have appropriated the schizophrenic woman as the symbol of linguistic, religious, and sexual breakdown and rebellion." And of course, you definitely see that with Zelda Fitzgerald as well, who Lisa mentioned. It is by no means clear that Marilyn Monroe was clinically schizophrenic ever in her life. My own armchair diagnosis, for what it's worth, is that she certainly wasn't. She didn't have delusions or hallucinations or any of the dissociative linguistic hallmarks of schizophrenia. She wasn't catatonic. She didn't hear voices. She even more clearly had none of the symptoms of DID, which is marked by amnesia and fugue states, extended blackout periods. She was depressed, although whether her depression was caused or exacerbated by her circumstances is impossible to tell. Her general practitioner, Hyman Engelberg, was interviewed after her death saying, "We knew that she was a manic depressive, which is now called bipolar personality." But that GP making that diagnosis many, many years after the fact is a diagnosis not reported in any of the principal biographies. So everybody is making all of these competing diagnoses. Monroe may have become paranoid before she died, as some biographers, notably Barbara Leeming, claim. But again, this is also a symptom of drug addiction. The cultural association of Monroe with schizophrenia is one of many ways in which Marilyn is representative of so many post-war versions of femininity. It also shows the pathology of the literal. When she looks like two different people, she will be diagnosed as schizophrenic in common parlance. In fact, in the story of Marilyn, identity is constructed as so necessarily stable that change itself becomes pathological. This is seen most clearly in the stories of Marilyn's supposed transformation from someone called Norma Jean into an entirely different person called Marilyn, a transformation that is pathologized in virtually every account of Marilyn's life, and I mean every account of Marilyn's life. In leaving Norma Jean behind, the story goes, Marilyn made the dangerous decision to abandon her real self, and that way madness lies. Of course, if this were true, we'd also have stories about a man named Marion Morrison destroyed by John Wayne, or Archie Leach who drove Cary Grant mad. As I note in the book, we don't have any stories about how, you know, Frances Gum destroyed Judy Garland. But in Marilyn's case, changing her name becomes a story about split identity. The more literal the difference between the two, the more lethal it grows. And in a film version that some of you might know, HBO's film called Marilyn / Norma Jean went so far as to cast two different actors to play the same woman. Ashley Judd played Norma Jean, while Mira Sorvino played Marilyn Monroe. The split between the two was not, however, merely temporal, so it isn't the case that in the first half of the film, Ashley Judd plays Norma Jean and then Mira Sorvino plays Marilyn, which would be a little bit exaggerated, but at least would make sense. The film continued to place them together in scenes that depicted dialogues, arguments, and fights between them. Norma Jean remains symbolically inside Marilyn Monroe throughout the film, but in actuality physically outside Marilyn Monroe because she was an entirely different person. Ultimately, the film suggested that this split identity was the cause of Marilyn Monroe's death, which it wrote as deliberate and unproblematic suicide. Marilyn, played by Mira Sorvino, screams at Norma Jean, played by Ashley Judd, who is in the mirror, which is how they can have each other looking at each other, I know how to make you shut up, and they both proceed to swallow several bottles of pills simultaneously. Right? So this is why Marilyn Monroe died, because she changed her name and dyed her hair. And this demonstrates that she was insane. And what happens throughout the story, and I won't go into very many other details, but I can. There are plenty of them. This is really sort of the subject of my book, and I can certainly give you other ones. But basically, this is what happens, is that as Marilyn tries to grow, and as she tries to educate herself, and as she, any time that she tries to change, it gets pathologized, and it becomes a sign of madness, it becomes a sign of instability. None of this is to say, of course, that Marilyn Monroe wasn't insecure, anxious, perhaps unstable. She certainly was later. Depressed, as I've said, and later in life definitely addicted to chemicals. As a child, she was passed through a series of foster homes and at least one orphanage, and was probably sexually molested, perhaps more than once. Needless to say, these claims have also been disputed, but then we have a history as a society of not believing girls who say they have been assaulted, so I choose to give her the benefit of the doubt. She climbed the Hollywood ladder the hard way, by means of ambition, hard work, beauty, a magical screen presence, and one other requirement in Hollywood in the late 1940s, which was submitting to the casting couch. She didn't have much of a choice, as she later explained. If you didn't give in, there were 100 girls who would. These are not scurrilous rumors of Monroe sleeping her way to the top, in other words. Later in life, she was open about some of the compromises she'd made and her reasons for making them. And again, I see no reason to pathologize such pragmatic choices. So here she was in late 1955, at the age of 29, having been passed around, passed over, kicked around, and she'd had enough. So she left Hollywood for New York, determined to prove herself in the East, where it matters in America. In a notebook dated around this time, Monroe admonished herself to, quote, know reality or things as they are, and as they are is underscored, and to have as few illusions as possible. Train my will now. I can and will help myself and work on things analytically, no matter how painful. If I forget things, the unconscious wants to forget. I will only try to remember. Discipline. Concentration. My body is my body, every part of it. Feel what I feel within myself, that is trying to become aware of it. Also what I feel in others. Not being ashamed of my feelings, thoughts, or ideas. Realize the things that they are. Having a sense of myself. In New York, she began dating Arthur Miller, the nation's preeminent playwright, and fighting Fox Studio to wrest control of her films and her career back from them. In late 1956, it seems she had prevailed. She married Miller, converting to Judaism to do so, won a new contract with Fox, which gave her directorial and script approval for the first time in her career, created an independent production company, and hired Sir Laurence Olivier to direct and co-star in her company's first film. She and Miller flew off to London to film The Prince and the Showgirl, and Marilyn Monroe had won. until she appeared at Pinewood Studios, anxious, hopeful, uncertain, desperate for approval, and was told by Olivier, "Just be sexy, Marilyn, dear." Until she read in Arthur Miller's diary, which he had left out, that he had thought he had married an angel, but it looked like he was wrong. So disappointing when a goddess turns out to be a human being and can't redeem you after all. Metaphors are such a bitch, just like Marilyn. Her acting coach, Paula Strasberg, tried to comfort Marilyn by telling her that a diary was for free associating. And it is certainly true that psychoanalysis in the 1950s was in vogue, and even a lofty playwright like Miller, if you hear some sarcasm here, I hope that's coming through, of whom one of his closest friends once said that he was more interested in humanity than in human beings, might have been susceptible to some of its more popularized tenets. Marilyn supposedly responded to Strasberg's consolation with one of my favorite of her ripostes. She supposedly said, "Yeah, but I wouldn't leave my head wide open for the person I was thinking about to see. That's a little too Freudian." She understood passive aggression just as well as she understood the aggressive kind. She later told William Weatherby, a Guardian journalist who recommended that she read Norman Mailer's book about Hollywood, The Deer Park, that she hadn't cared for it because Mailer was too impressed by power and, in her opinion, did not understand how it worked. Weatherby wrote later, quote, "She made thinking seem like a serious, deliberate process. Some people who never got over seeing her as a dumb blonde will assume that I am implying she found thinking difficult. Quite the opposite," he says. "She gave thinking her serious attention." The problem was how few people gave her serious attention, except for what she could bring them. After the sudden collapse of her high hopes during the filming of The Prince and the Showgirl, Marilyn collapsed too, descending into a spiral of pills and alcohol for the rest of the film's production. And to be clear, I'm not implying that this episode started her on drugs, although no one knows exactly when she started taking pills, merely that it definitely provoked a crisis from which she took chemical refuge. Things spiraled downward, the film production seemed doomed, and Marilyn's therapist, Dr. Hohenberg, was flown into London from New York. It was on Hohenberg's recommendation, supposedly, that Marilyn came here to see Anna Freud. When Marilyn, then those the notes from those meetings, if any, survive, are, and I'll say a little bit more about where they might be, but they've never been made public. When Marilyn returned to New York, she began regular treatment with Marianne Kreese, the daughter of Sigmund Freud's friend, Oscar Reese. Freud called her his adopted daughter, and all her life, Marianne Kreese remained close to Anna Freud. Kreese had an office in the same building where the Strasbergs lived, which made it handy for Marilyn in New York because she would go see the Strasbergs and then she could also see Dr. Kreese for analysis. And Kreese was an academic psychoanalyst, cultured, brilliant, respected. And in fact, Kreese later died here in Anna Freud's home. A pattern is emerging. This beautiful, intelligent, anxious, and embattled woman constantly sought education and approval from the people with the most cultural authority. Crazy. What was she thinking? She wasn't an angel, but she was a perfectionist. She wasn't mad, but she was furious. When Marilyn was on the West Coast filming, she began seeing Dr. Ralph Greenson, whom Dr. Kreese recommended. He had worked with Hollywood stars before and thought he could help Marilyn. But the people she trusted most, the people with all the authority, were not perhaps the best equipped to help her. Throughout their marriage, Arthur Miller persisted in idealizing her. That seemed to be his idea of the greatest gift he could give. Rather than seeing her as a human being and loving her with her flaws, or even not seeing them as flaws, he kept trying to erase what he saw as flaws, repressing her past because he thought it shameful. In truth, she really didn't think it was shameful, but she kept fearing he might be right. Miller wrote The Misfits for her, in which she plays a tree-hugging hysteric who rescues men by symbolizing all of redemptive, beatific womankind. That's got to make you feel better. The role, conceived as a Valentine for Marilyn, a character named Rosalind, cleverly disguised as Rosalind, is written as emotional, intuitive, and passive. A woman who, as Marilyn herself noted, convinces the men in the film by having a screaming, crazy fit rather than by reasoning with them or persuading them. It was the end of 1960. The filming of The Misfits was famously a disaster. Her marriage was over. Marilyn was furious, betrayed, depressed. She fell apart, and her alcohol and drug abuse spiraled downwards once more. When she saw Dr. Kreese at the beginning of 1961, Kreese was so concerned that she convinced Marilyn to check into a psychiatric hospital. It was a dreadful mistake. It was unquestionably well-meaning, certainly, but it was a terrible error in judgment. On the advice of Dr. Kreese, Marilyn checked herself into the Payne-Whitney Hospital on February 7th, 1961. addicted to barbiturates, it is very possible that she didn't really understand what Dr. Kreese told her. Certainly, she did not expect what she found when she got there. Traumatized at being on a psychiatric ward, like her mother, she threatened self-harm and hurled furniture around the room. "If you are going to treat me like a nut, I'll act like a nut," she told them. Attendants told her to sew or play checkers, even cards, and maybe knit. "The day I did that," she later wrote to Greenson, "they would have a nut on their hands." Eventually, she was carried bodily, face down, by four attendants to the elevator. Transferred to the violent ward, she was forcibly sedated and restrained. She contacted Leon Paula Strasberg and her ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio. DiMaggio arrived on the 10th of February and threatened to dismantle the hospital brick by brick if they didn't release her into his care. DiMaggio does not always emerge a hero from the story of Marilyn Monroe. There is good reason to believe that he was abusive toward her during their marriage. But you gotta love him for going to Payne Whitney and saying he was gonna take the hospital down brick by brick unless they released her. In consultation with Chris, DiMaggio had her transferred to Columbia Presbyterian, a general care hospital rather than a psychiatric institution. She stayed at Columbia Pres for 3 weeks, lying awake nights, reading Freud's published correspondence. She insisted that his photograph looked depressed and disappointed with life, although Chris told her that Freud was in physical pain when the photo was taken. Marilyn never believed it. She said, "He just looks so disappointed." Marilyn ripped Dr. Kreese to shreds when she was released, which left the analyst, she later said, trembling. "I did a terrible thing, a terrible thing. Oh, God, I didn't mean to, but I did." Marilyn was not necessarily a fragile person. By all accounts, she was tough as nails, made of steel, a beautiful hummingbird made of iron, in one friend's memorable formulation. But by this point, her emotional state was unquestionably fragile, and emotionally, she probably never really recovered from the Payne-Whitney episode. For the next year, she relied upon Dr. Greenson as her primary doctor and cultivated a close family relationship with him that has since unsurprisingly provoked a great deal of criticism and controversy. Marilyn had a history of finding surrogate families, including Arthur Miller's family, the Strasbergs, and now the Greensons. Like Dr. Kreese, Greenson certainly meant well, although his judgment may have been clouded by his own ego and ambition as well. Elizabeth Young Brule, Anna Freud's biographer, described Greenson as, quote, "a hard-living man of passionate enthusiasm and even flamboyance, a man for whom psychoanalysis was a way of life." Others have called him narcissistic. He was close to Anna Freud, and he encouraged his wealthier clients to donate to this Hampstead clinic. Again, a controversial decision. John Huston hired Jean-Paul Sartre to write a script about the life of Freud and wanted Marilyn to play the female lead, a patient with hysteria. Greenson convinced her not to, saying that Anna Freud was firmly opposed to the film. Whatever one thinks about the project's merits, Marilyn might well have been great in such a role, although given the timing and her psychiatric state at the time, it might also have further tested her shaky emotional equilibrium. It's clear from many accounts, including her own notes and diaries, the recollections of those who knew her, and indeed her screen performances, how Marilyn was growing and learning. And it's important to note how much of her adult education came filtered through the prism of psychoanalysis. The people who were teaching her were also her analysts, and her reflections on herself often merge analytical concepts with epistemological ones for obvious reasons. She understood the consequences of her insecure childhood, writing in 1962 of herself, quote, "the lack of any consistent love and caring, a mistrust and fear of the world was the result. There were no benefits except what it could teach me about the basic needs of the young, the sick, and the weak. I have great feeling for all the persecuted ones in the world. In times of crisis," she added, "I try to think and use my understanding." In the final year of her life, Monroe was consulting with Dr. Greenson 7 times a week at his home, later twice daily at his home and sometimes at her home, even living in Greenson's house for a time. After her sessions with Greenson, she often stayed for dinner and became friends with his children, advising his teenage daughter on dating, shopping, and the like. Greenson advised Marilyn on purchasing a new house, on staff, he recommended her live-in housekeeper, on friends and lovers, and on film contracts, even intervening with the studio on a number of films, most notably her last unfinished film, Something's Gotta Give. Many of Greenson's papers, archived at UCLA, are embargoed until January 1st, 2039, including notes about Monroe and some of his other famous patients, including Vivian Lee, Vincenti Minnelli, and Kim Stanley. Since her death, Marilyn has been diagnosed by armchair psychiatrists, otherwise known as psychobiographers, again and again. For what it's worth, Dr. Greenson diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder. But borderlines have a relationship to PTSD that is worth remembering. And it is also worth bearing in mind how gendered assumptions are about borderlines, how much they are on a spectrum from old ideas about hysteria. Indeed, the diagnosis of hysteria is absurdly literalized in Marilyn's case, so that most of her male biographers actually do think her problem is her womb. I'll give just one example, and this comes from my book. Fred Lawrence Giles, who was the first biographer of Marilyn and is often called the most authoritative biographer of Marilyn, wrote his first biography in 1969, and then he revised it in the early 1980s. And he opens his revised biography, which is called Norma Jean, The Life and Death of Marilyn Monroe, there's that split personality again, with a description of the house Monroe bought in February 1962, 6 months before she died. She bought it, says Giles, because she failed to conceive a child with Arthur Miller and had just learned that he and his new wife, Inga Morath, were expecting a baby. As a consequence, she retreated to what he calls a womb-like environment, which Giles describes as an extension of herself, and which he adds was empty, unfurnished, cramped, with no place to conceal anything and on a dead end. Miller told Giles in an interview that he did not consider Inga's pregnancy a motive for Monroe's suicide because Monroe already knew that, quote, there wasn't anything wrong with Miller that had kept the couple from conceiving a child. The fact that Marilyn died a full 6 months after learning of the pregnancy would seem a more compelling reason to discount it as a motive for her alleged suicide, but Giles nonetheless concludes that Monroe was in despair because she knew that she was the reason they never had any children together. Quote, Inga Miller was the whole woman she could never be. Despite the fact that Marilyn Monroe was and remains one of the biggest and most popular movie stars of all time, the stories about her years of stardom focus not upon professional success, but upon personal failure. Both Monroe's marriages and her career are always undermined by her failure to be a whole woman. In particular, as Giles' portrait demonstrates, her defects will continually be associated, whether directly or indirectly, with sexual or gynecological problems. It's not just the men who do this. Gloria Steinem concludes that Monroe's alleged sexual problems demonstrate her incompleteness, and she quotes Greenson to make her case. Dr. Greenson's notes conclude that Marilyn found it difficult to sustain a series of orgasms with the same individual. That incompleteness could have been the reason why Greenson believed that Marilyn feared and yet was drawn into situations with homosexual coloring. Perhaps, this is still Steinem, but by her own testimony, she didn't find sexual satisfaction in affairs with either men or women. Steinem's equation of orgasm with a complete identity, an ego ideal, returns sexuality to the center of Monroe's identity. According to Giles, the partial woman moves into an unfinished house, a symbolic womb, to compensate for the failures of her real womb, which was as empty as the house and in which she would die. And all of this happens on the first page of Giles' biography. None of the major biographies begins with Marilyn Monroe triumphing. They start with death, madness, childlessness, and they end there too. I don't have time to talk today about the historical links between sex, madness, and death and the social construction and representation of women, but then again, that seems super erogatory at the Freud Museum. Tonight, however, it strikes me that on the eve of the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination, I do think I should mention another misogynistic presumption, that she must have been in love with JFK to sleep with him. Nobody admits that she might have just wanted to have sex with the president. That doesn't seem to, I mean, even Joyce Carol Oates, she must have been in love with him. I know she was 36 years old, she'd been divorced 3 times, she was one of the biggest movie stars in the world, maybe she just liked shagging the president. I'm sorry. Thank you. As Jacqueline Rose once wrote, if a diagnosis is in order, it should be clear by now that Monroe is not the one whom I find it most helpful to think of in terms of being ill. Suffering, without question. We talk endlessly about Marilyn's need for love, her desperate insecurities, her inadequacies, because talking about her anxieties quiets our own by making her sound like an anomaly and reproving her for her shortcomings. But why do we find Marilyn so blameworthy for somehow having failed to acquire self-esteem, as if she misplaced it or forgot to get in the queue for it? Where precisely was her sense of worth supposed to come from, if not from others? Self-esteem derives from feeling valued by others, and it is precisely that validation our culture has always sneeringly withheld from her and then blamed her for lacking. Offered precious little of it as a child, Marilyn did the sensible, the mature thing as an adult. She tried to learn how to acquire self-confidence in the realm she could control. She was always trying to make up her own mind in every sense of the phrase. Instead, she was accused of insanity. She tried to change her own mind, hoping that this might change the minds of others about her. In her own words, she sought to build a foundation in her work. Quote, my work is the only ground I've ever had to stand on. To put it bluntly, I seem to have a whole superstructure with no foundation, but I'm working on the foundation. But no one wanted a grounded Marilyn. They wanted her floating above Times Square. They wanted tinsel. Marilyn was a casualty of the Puritan work ethic. She worked extraordinarily hard. She succeeded immeasurably, and yet we continue smugly to insist that she failed in all the things that matter. Marilyn's need to be loved was no different from that of everyone else in kind. Perhaps it was greater in degree, but perhaps not. The same can be said of her insecurities, her anxieties. They were powerful, and she was not particularly good at ignoring them, but she certainly fought them. Her lack of confidence, her stage fright, her diffidence about her lack of education, she battled against them all, determined to show herself and everyone else that she was worthwhile. I finally made up my mind I wanted to be an actress, and I was not going to let my lack of confidence ruin my chances, she said. My illusions didn't have anything... Sorry, I'm throwing paper around. I'm getting all excited and throwing paper around. My illusions didn't have anything to do with being a fine actress, she said. I knew how third-rate I was. I could actually feel my lack of talent, as if it were cheap clothes I was wearing inside. But my God, how I wanted to learn, to change, to improve. She tried to change, but we didn't let her, because then we'd have to change our minds and admit she was one of America's greatest success stories instead of our favorite tragic myth. I began working on Marilyn when I was doing a PhD on Sylvia Plath. It ended up being called Dead Metaphors, Writing Marilyn Monroe, Sylvia Plath, and Janis Joplin. And my book on Marilyn, which came out of that thesis, uses Marilyn as a case study of the practices and malpractices of biography. To me, it was always a literary book about the narratives, metaphors, rhetorical, and evidentiary strategies of biography. Marilyn is not a character in my book because part of my reading is resistance to the notion that she is only an icon, only a textual construction. But having written a book about a movie star in a superficial culture, from which academia is certainly not exempt, I found it ridiculously difficult to convince people that literature is what I do. And so I decided to write about Scott Fitzgerald, whom I've always loved, and The Great Gatsby, one of our masterpieces and one of my favorite books, and discovered to my surprise that in writing about Scott, I was writing about Zelda, yet another mad woman who was not mad, yet another brilliant, frustrated, ambitious, beautiful woman. I felt I knew this time, however, how to approach the question of Zelda's madness because I'd had a lot of practice. The other thing I realized, to my surprise, as I was working on The Great Gatsby, is that I'd been working on a character like Gatsby for some time, and she was called Marilyn Monroe. Like Fitzgerald's vision of Jay Gatsby, Marilyn Monroe sprang from a platonic conception of herself. But unlike Gatsby, she did not stay faithful to her youthful conception to the end. The problem was that no one wanted her to reinvent herself a second time. It is a truism that Marilyn was desire incarnate, but we misconstrue what those desires were, seeing only our own, instead of the fact that hers are really what drive the tale. Marilyn distilled and radiated America's most treasured assurances. In the beginning, she soaked them up. She trusted that success would ensure esteem, that it should earn wealth, and that all of these things together would prove her worth. Crazy, like I said. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, for that fantastic portrayal of Marilyn, which I think rings very true. I see the hands are already going up, so I won't even take first bite, but I may come back later.
Please do.
Yes.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
You must know me.
Yes, I do. Hi, Lois. How are you?
I noticed you didn't mention my biography, which surprised me. I published a biography of Marilyn, very long, 400 pages, 10 years of research, 75 friends interviewed, on and on and on. Not that I necessarily disagree with you. I do call Marilyn a genius in my book. I also have seen the Greenson psychiatric records. I tracked them down. They're not available at UCLA, which is my university. But I found a way to get the Xeroxes of them. The psychiatric records are very, very interesting, as is the fact that Marilyn, you know about the demons she saw. Mm-hmm. You're aware of that. Mm-hmm. She saw demons. That's mm-hmm. from the memoir of her best friend, Ralph Roberts, mm-hmm. whom everyone I talked to in Hollywood, including Patricia Newcomb, said was the most reliable source on Marilyn. And Greenson psychiatric records focus on the fact that Marilyn thought she was lesbian and was very, very bothered by that. I tracked down one of her lesbian affairs in the records of the Margaret Herrick Library. So I want to see, you and I have a completely different approach. Mm-hmm. You're cultural
yes,
studies.
We do.
I'm history.
I'm literature.
I do the base. Mm-hmm. You do the superstructure. So what I'm wondering about is I find the biographical tradition on Marilyn very interesting. I found Giles' book fascinating. Do you know what it's like to get this data on Marilyn? It's horrible. It's awful. It's extremely difficult. I talked to Marianne Chris's daughter. She wouldn't talk to me. I wanted the psychiatric records. So what Giles is very good on the families. He did wonderful interviewing of the families. Anthony Summers' book. Anthony's very embarrassed by that book.
Oh, he should be.
What he really did his research on was the death. And his research on the death is extraordinary. I've read all his interviews. He's embarrassed by what he said about her life. The publisher forced him to do that. So what I'm saying is, I think what you're doing here, and I think I do it, every biographer does it, I've written five biographies, when you write about someone, you construct them in your image. Mm-hmm. And I think the Marilyn you're telling us about is partly you. The Marilyn I constructed is partly me.
Sure. Do you see demons?
Well, yeah, exactly.
I do know what was wrong with her mother, and it was not schizophrenia. It was the toxic material in the lab.
Okay. Spoto has a different explanation for what it was that went to her brain. As far as my Marilyn being a self-portrait of me, I don't want to give the end of my book away to anybody who might be thinking about reading it. 10 years ago, I finished it with a section called My Marilyn, which I say if every biographer has their own Marilyn, here's mine, and it's a self-portrait. So yes, I agree. We all know that. What happens is that you can put it a different way, which is to say, are we projecting? Probably. We have a person who none of us met, who we're reconstructing through textual revenants of various kinds and other kinds of material traces, film, stills, what have you. And all we can do is interpret those to the best of our ability and using the fullest of our intelligence and being as intellectually honest as we can. Hang on, you've had your say, so give me a second. It seems to me that the degree to which we try as thinkers about a person like Marilyn Monroe, the degree to which we try to be honest about that is that we can say that identification is projection. We can also say that what it enables us to do is to see certain sides of that person that other people are not necessarily seeing. And it seems very clear to me from a lot of what Marilyn has said, and I tried to give some of the examples here for why I believe this, that Marilyn wanted desperately to be respected as a professional person.
Oh, I agree.
And
I agree.
Thank you. The question, as I tried to say throughout, I still think it's very much an open question, how much of her undoubted later mental distress and psychiatric traumas were exacerbated by what you know was a really serious chemical addiction for most of her adult life. And I don't know how we can retroactively go back and disentangle those. Ralph Arbert says that she saw demons. Well, you know, she was taking an awful lot of drugs. So that will do it.
Excuse me. You've had your go. We've got other questions.
Okay.
We've got another question in the back there. Jacqueline, was that you? Did you have your hand up?
Jacqueline here.
Oh. Okay. There's a hand up here. Could you stand up so we can see you? Yeah.
Which is famous actresses reading Marilyn's own words.
Yeah. I'm actually in it.
this wonderful woman, an octogenarian, Amy Green, who repeatedly was her best friend, and she said that Marilyn was the love of Marilyn's life as John Pye. Mm.
Yeah.
And rolling on, and everybody wants to have some kind of purchase.
Yeah.
But in response to the talk and context of being here, I'm just wondering whether Marilyn was a victim of psychoanalysis, that patients like psychoanalysis. Mm. The way you framed your talk, you started with her breakdown. Mm. Obviously, film is a very intense experience. Mm. So I'm a filmmaker. I have a breakdown every time I make a film. So I understand that. But there is some. There does seem something a bit murky about. Mm.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think it's a really fraught question. And again, I think it's a difficult one to answer in one sense. It's certainly there are people who have held that psychoanalysis did a great deal of damage to Marilyn, most notably Donald Spoto in his biography. But it's hard because in his case, right, that's framed as this, to me, very patronizing reading in which she's just this kind of natural, unformed talent who shouldn't have tried to be conscious about it because she was better when she was unconscious, which is pretty much what Billy Wilder said and what a lot of her directors said, that she should have just gone on, you know, being intuitive. And, of course, that's a very gendered sort of way of, you know, talking about women's talents anyway. So as I was trying to suggest, it seems to me that the fact that that what she was trying to do was to get educated, and that came to her through psychoanalysis, and she was trying to be educated about herself. So I have to say I resist the idea that damaged her. The question about whether her individual doctors overstepped the line. There are a lot of questions about Greenson, as I implied there, about whether, you know, he overstepped the client-patient. You know, the proper boundaries. Again, I think it's clear he was well-meaning, and he said in his own defense that, you know, that she was damaged enough that he thought she wasn't strong enough for psychoanalysis, so he was trying to kind of make her strong enough that she could do that, and he thought that this was maybe an experimental way of helping with that. You know, I think when I come down to it, I feel like John Huston said at the end of her life that if she was the victim of anyone, it was of her own friends, And I sometimes think that he's right, but not that they were victimizing her in any conscious or malicious way, but rather that they, as I said, it's very hard to do this without starting to sound very judgmental and starting to, you know, have a go at people that, as I say, you've never met, and I think you should give people the benefit of the doubt. And so I think that on the whole, these people, of course there were people who were out for what they could get from her, who were exploiting her, of course there were. But there were also people who meant well, who loved her, who were trying to help her. And in various ways, I think that the concatenation of historical and cultural forces, I mean, if I'm honest, I think that psychoanalysis as a therapy was probably not the therapy best suited for her particular, demons, to be metaphorical about it. But again, you know, that's all in retrospect because it didn't work. So who's to say?
I think one of the things I learned when I was doing some work on Greenson and Marilyn for Mad, Bad, and Sad was I read Greenson's own writings, and it's quite clear that he was trying to construct some kind of theoretical base using Marilyn as one of the experiences, if you like.
That helped the super rich.
What he was doing was talking, because everybody was accusing him, taking her into his family, and, you know, he said he was trying to actually give her the family that she had never had and show her how to, you know, relate within family structure and build up her boundaries in that way. What's interesting about that, in terms of what goes on these days in some of the more innovative psychotherapeutic practices, is they are trying to do that with borderlines, just in that way. And it's a question of setting up a kind of environment which is relatively safe and allowing them to relive in adult form some of the structures that build up the personality. Who knows?
I think what we see with the case of Greenson as well is that if we do believe in the model of transference, that the problem then what happened with Marilyn and also with some of his other patients was that once you build up that much trust, though, you can't actually go through the transference process because it was very difficult for him then to let her get angry at him, and it was very difficult for her to get angry at him. And so you actually can't kind of create even the model for that particular
I think it was,
you know,
difficult.
Process.
And of course, she never just stopped taking all the drugs.
Well, exactly.
She was a celebrity, the word we haven't used.
Absolutely.
And we see this time and again in this particular kinds of situations. Yeah. So other questions? There, yes.
All the relationships that you kind of spoke about seem to be really kind of unbounded, and everyone seems to overstep the line, and they're all kind of very sexy, very interesting relationships. Was there any more boring but more boundary relationships with anybody in her life?
It's a really interesting way of putting it. And I mean, certainly I think that she had, I mean, the question before was about her relationship with Amy Green, who was married to Milton Green, who was a photographer who became her partner. But again, actually, yeah, the Greens took her in. So another surrogate family. She ended up living with people a lot. So I think that what happened was, you know, she started out, she had very strong and you know, appropriately bounded relationships, actually, with her stepchildren, with whom she was very close. And they loved her very much, and she wrote, there were wonderful letters that Lois discovered that she wrote to her stepchildren, where she's, you know, just writing them about summer camp and, you know, what's going on and giving them advice about dating and stuff. And so I think that those are, I hate to, you know, I can't use the word normal. I mean, it's so problematic in so many ways, right? It is not the case, let's put it this way, I'll do it as a negative. It is not the case that every relationship that she had was toxic or in some way problematic. That is not the case. And she had plenty of strong professional relationships as well. Jane Russell always spoke with warmth about her, so did Lauren Bacall. The people, many of her co-stars, male and female, she was very close to Montgomery Clift. You know, there was that terrible story about people said that Clark Gable, that she was to blame for Clark Gable's death after the filming of The Misfits, which he died soon afterwards of a heart attack, and that the stress of the production kind of driven him over the edge. But everything that he said about her was that he was very fond of her and that he liked her. So I think she inspired a great deal of love and respect with people that she, I mean, she drove them crazy sometimes, but because she was difficult to work with. But a lot of personal love and respect, as well as the professional admiration and the kind of, you know, all of her directors, even the ones who were maddest at her, would talk about how luminous she was on the screen and how, you know, nobody else could do what she could do on screen. But Billy Wilder would say things, you know, I hated her guts, but God, she was good on the screen. But a lot of them didn't say that, you know, a lot of them were willing to say also how fond they remained of her.
Jackie Rose in the back. Could you project louder?
I agree.
She crossed borders. Mm-hmm. She hung out with and slept with women, communists, Negroes, and Jews. She was a sexual radical in certain ways. She was also very left-wing. Mm-hmm. She was being trailed by the FBI at the end of her life. She became more left-wing, as Lois Banner makes very clear in her stunning autobiography, so I recommend it. She makes it very, very clear that she became more left-wing after she divorced Arthur Miller. So the myth that he politicized is completely fraudulent.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
And she was educating herself all her life and reading. And the photograph of her leaving Ulysses, a famous one taken by Eve Arnold, is considered by many people as a piece of staginess that's sort of dismissed, and it's dismissed. In fact, she was a passionate reader, and she read widely. She read histories of the blacks in America. You know, she read Steinbeck.
Well, I totally agree with every bit of that, and I've spent a lot of my book on exactly those ideas.
Invites us to make a diagnosis, and I think she really displays
narrative that Green sort of diagnosed her as borderline to justify his treatment of her, which is to say that he was breaking the rules, he was bringing her into the home, and he then classifies her as borderline. I remember Jacqueline Miller once saying borderline is a category that has been invented by psychoanalysts to explain the failure of their own treatment from Dark Wilson. Right? I say it's a meaningless category in a way. So I think we've got to be very, very careful about calling her borderline, indeed about calling her anything.
I was just being historical, Jacqueline, because he had used that terminology, and it wasn't. It was used very differently by a lot of the other analysts at the time, as you know, and much more punitively than Greenson then used it and tried to elaborate it, which is the only reason I use it. I also think that it is true, though, that although the meanings of borderline have changed, it's still there, and there are still people who find life extremely difficult and whom nobody knows how to treat, and they would rather not treat them with drugs, which would be the worst thing to do. And therefore, they create these attempted therapeutic contracts with them, which facilitate their ability to live in an environment. I'm using all these gobbledygook terms because I'm remembering very, very distinctly the way it was explained to me by the people who do this, who do long-term care, a kind of care in the community for people who are called now borderline personality disorders. That's all.
I just like to
I don't think Marilyn was like that. I mean, but I do think she probably engaged people to give her the kind of attentive care that she thought she needed. And so you end up, I'm not saying Greenson is innocent by any respect, I mean, whatever that means, but I think there was some kind of contractual stuff going on between them that was unspoken.
Well, I think that was true, though, in so many of her relationships. I mean, I agree with Jacqueline about the question of, you know, of the usefulness of these diagnostic categories and the question of what do we do with them. I hope it was clear that I was certainly not agreeing with the diagnoses that I was describing. It seemed to me, the more that I read about it, the more that, and I'm not talking about this in terms of therapeutic practice, but in terms of the way that people write about Marilyn Monroe after she's dead. And, I mean, there was an article I found as I was, you know, thinking through this, a new article, relatively recent, in a journal about Melanie Klein that ended with therapeutic recommendations. It was a case study of Marilyn Monroe and then ended with therapeutic recommendations. And I thought, well, I'm afraid you're a little late. I mean, that's not going to really work. What is the point of that? And it seems to me that when people start writing about this, that what might have a diagnostic use in real life simply becomes a rhetorical strategy when it's after the fact. To me, it is nothing more than a rhetorical strategy. And I quite agree that as a rhetorical strategy, borderline means nothing. It literally means nothing. It becomes the catch-all thing for her. And it's so gendered. It's so, the writing about it is so much like the writing about 19th century hysterics. It's untrue. And that's why I brought up the example of Giles in the womb. I mean, all of that stuff just kind of comes together for me. As far as the point about her education goes, I couldn't agree more, and I spend a lot of time, you know, writing about this and thinking about it, and it's absolutely why I defend the idea that, as I say, not that I'm projecting onto her, but rather that I'm seeing in her the things that I respond to and that I can see that she was fighting for. And absolutely, you know, she was attending classes at UCLA. She was, as you say, she was reading all of these books. And all of the snobbery and the sneering that comes into it, people say, oh, well, she was just staging it. She couldn't have read Ulysses. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, you wrote about this, about her reading Lincoln Steffens and this. I mean, she was reading all kinds of stuff. And she was reading, she read Dostoevsky and she wanted to play Griselda in The Brothers Karamazov, and everybody mocked her for that, right? And she said, it's not like I was saying I wanted to play King Lear. You know, give me a break. I mean, she was trying to play part, but so this was the thing, right? So that everybody sneered at her because she couldn't act at the beginning of her career. And she was not a particularly technically skilled actress at the beginning of her career. I think that's a fair statement. But she had a lot of talent, and she had a lot of charisma on screen. And so what did she do? She went to the most eminent actors, you know, studio, the place to learn about acting in the country, and then they sneered at her for getting above herself. I mean, she literally could not win. It was a complete no-win. She was constantly, constantly trying to educate herself and better herself, and she was fighting for respect. And it's that to me is incontrovertible, and it seems to me that it is that's why I keep coming back to that interpretation. And so as far as what do we do with somebody with mental distress? Well, I think that one of the things that we do, surely, is treat it with respect. But also, I think that it's on a spectrum. We keep treating her as if she's this entirely different creature who's mad and say, well, actually, no, that's what I'm saying. I mean, maybe her insecurities and her anxieties were profound. They were real. But are they different in kind from everybody else's? I don't think that they are. Other people need, and that's why I ended with that. Other people, we need self-esteem. We need the approval of others. We need people to love us. We need all of those things. And she was trying to create those things in whatever sort of compromised, haphazard, and problematic ways that she did. And those seem to me all eminently sane and sensible things for her to have tried to do.
Okay, because I've got another question here.
Hmm? Same as Sylvia.
Absolutely. Absolutely the same.
Question here. Just here.
On the topic of the film Love, Marilyn, which was mentioned, I did actually see that at the London Film Festival. And something that struck me from that film is you obviously touched on her relationships with her colleagues. So many of them adored Marilyn, and they got on really well. But where Marilyn struggled a lot, and this was sort of touched on a lot in the film, was how much she struggled with the network executives of 20th Century Fox, and how, and you touched on it yourself in your book, and just actually how much systematic workplace bullying she suffered, actually, as a worker. Mm. How severely...
And sexual harassment.
Sexual harassment, and just undermining all of her efforts, all of her ideas, and just systematically putting her down, and how much her confidence eroded as a result, and the fact that she felt the pressure, because she, when she was younger, she suffered from speech impediments and stuttering, and how vulnerable she felt in that regard. And so as an adult professional, she felt that, and because she was a perfectionist, she felt that she had to hire a speech coach or a speech therapist to be on the set with her, and how disruptive that was to the rest of the crew and cast and colleagues that she worked with, and including herself, how much that further set her into this sort of crisis of confidence. Mm. And so I just wonder, might it be helpful to reorganize the conversation around the difficulties that she suffered, her emotional crises, not so much around like whether or not she was mad, but whether or not, in fact, she was a victim of workplace bullying, how the fact that I don't personally find it that surprising that she, you know, she died not long after she got sacked by 20th Century Fox, how she had been on sickness absence for many weeks over the course of filming Something Got to Give.
Yeah.
And so how much workplace bullying was such a huge part?
I mean, I think, I don't know if you could all hear that, but it was a question about workplace bullying and about the difficulties that she had professionally on set. And just a couple of things to pick up on there, I think. And the question was also about whether her death might have related to the fact that she'd been fired from the set of Something's Gotta Give. The records show actually that she was rehired just before she died, and actually with a kind of triumphant new contract that she'd been fighting for. And so there's reason to believe that she was actually, that in professional terms, she was feeling pretty good, or she must have been, because that was a real, that was something she'd been fighting for a long time. Whether that was enough, you know, is another question. I think that it is, again, I mean, for me, I know this is always, I'm always kind of normalizing Marilyn, but that's because that's how I feel about her. She was a human being. She wasn't great. She wasn't this kind of magical creature of otherworldliness. So she was coping with all of these pressures. She was an insecure person who came from an unstable background. That made those sorts of things difficult for her. She was not formally educated, which she was very anxious about. And she was living at a time of rampant sexual harassment with these men who completely ruled the roost, and they were exploiting women left, right, and center. And so, yes, I think she found that very difficult. She became more or less aware fairly early on that her tactics were what we would now call, and I allude to this in the talk, what we would now call passive aggression. That was her sort of, she talks about that with The Prince and the Showgirl, to keep things on a London, keep our examples as Londonist as we can. She said Olivier looked at her like he was smelling a particularly bad piece of fish. And so she said, I started being bad with him, not showing up on time, not knowing my lines. And so she knew she was punishing them. She knew that that's what she was doing. It was her way of resisting. And she certainly did that with Zanuck. She certainly, it was very difficult for her to have those kinds of full-on confrontations because she didn't have the confidence. She didn't have the kinds of structures that would enable her to do that. And so she tended to find, and to me this is totally unsurprising. It seems like, in fact, it seems like the intelligent thing to do. That not necessarily successful or constructive, but like a perfectly sensible decision. And then that started to spiral. And then, but I think we must always remember the question of the drug abuse. So that yes, she had difficulty on set. Yes, she was harassed and bullied on set. She was treated terribly by Zanuck. But as far as the Misfits and Something's Gotta Give, by that point there were days and days and days on end where she was in a drugged stupor and not showing up on the set. And that's documented by virtually everybody. Her drug taking was quite reckless by the end and out of control. So I think, again, we have to take that into account. But for me, we also have to take that into account, as I've said all along, with the question of her mental distress, how much of that is exacerbated or indeed not caused by, because there were other reasons for her to be in emotional distress. But certainly the drug taking, you know, it had to increase the volatility and the pain.
Do you mind if I come to you next?
I just wanted to make a general comment, and that is this. I find that when I tell people that I wrote a book on Marilyn, they say to me, oh, the dumb blonde. Mm-hmm. It happened Tuesday night at a party of Oxford graduates.
Sure.
They started going off on dumb blondes with big boobs, and they turned on to me. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying here is we're dealing with a cultural mythology so strong.
Of course.
How do you change it? Mm.
There are a lot of very clever blondes in this room.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
A lot of very clever blondes here.
Exactly.
Power. She was, I think she was killed by the Kennedys, but
do
that's
you?
Whole other story.
Sure is. I think we won't be talking about that tonight.
I'm just saying, what does one do? It's very frustrating if you're a woman in this culture. Mm-hmm. Have these kinds of things thrown at you. Mm. And I think as we move into backlash, it's going to get worse.
Well, I think one of the things that we do is that we support each other, and we come out and we tell these stories and we listen to each other and
we eventually all dye our hair blonde.
Exactly. And we listen.
There was a question just here which I promised to take. Yes. Could you do you still have your question? Snyder.
Yes.
And I appreciated that a lot. And that I did after I saw the documentary film with all the extracts of her letters to Grimson. And then I saw the film in the London Film Festival. I tried to write a review, which I haven't yet published for a Greek journal. But the problem I find it's a very good talk. I mean, it's a very good, a lot of many good things you said, but I find that you stress too, you want to present her as a really whole, as a person who had a unity, as if a person who doesn't have a complete unity is mentally ill. And if we allow that Marilyn Monroe had moments of dissociative moments that she was mad or schizophrenic for that. In the little note I wrote, which is not published, I don't try to give any diagnosis. I'm a psychoanalyst. That's my background. And I don't try to give a diagnosis because I believe it's just limits the a person that had to fight on many fronts. Mm. And she really fought and lost. But we can't not see that there were moments, dissociative moments. And there is this discussion with Truman Capote, who was one of her best friends, where she
said,
yeah, well, anyway, she considered him. Okay, I'm not a biographer or historian or anything. As a psychoanalyst, I got some. Mm-hmm. Interest and for the family, the family question. She was coming back from the hairdressers, mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, what a shame! You have now you're platinum blonde, and she's you are so natural blonde." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Nobody's natural."
No, that's not quite what she said. What she said was, and I want to take up your point. No, so here's the, because I'm very fond of that Capote quotation, and I like it a lot. Yeah. And in fact, I end my book with it. What she says to him as he quotes it, he says, they were going to the funeral of Constance Collier, who was a great actress, and she comes with her hair in a scarf, and she says, "I'm sorry, I didn't have time to get my roots done beforehand, and I thought it would be disrespectful." So she's kind of covered up her hair. And but I'm coming to the details. So what? Because I disagree with your reading of her line totally. So what he says is, he quips at her and he says, "Oh dear me, and I thought you were a natural blonde." And she says, "I am, but nobody's that natural. And incidentally, fuck you." So hang on. That's what she says, right? So I'm sorry, I do not agree with a reading of that line as he quotes it. Hang on. Well, I'm just dealing with the incident, but this is what I mean, is that it's a question of tone, it's a question of context, it's a question of what we think we're reading for. Capote is telling a story in which she is quick-witted and funny, and she's saying nobody's that natural. We're all putting on a show. We can pathologize that and see that as evidence of dissociative disorder. Well, but I do not see that as a dissociative moment. I see that as a perfectly sensible thing, particularly for an actress, to say, but also it's the kind of thing that anybody could say, and it is not, to me, any kind of symptom of emotional distress whatsoever.
She's also talking to Truman Capote, who's one of the world's most
reliable sources.
I think there's another...
Yeah.
Do I?
No, I don't think so. I think...
I'm sorry to hear that. That was not my intention. I don't think so.
I think this book is called
The Many,
Many Lives. So it's hardly a unified life. Thank you for that. Another question. Just here, yes.
I guess I was thinking, just in terms of culture and cultural context, how the times, you know, most definitely the era, was, you know, such a difficult time for women who were trying to break through, especially women who are actresses who are trying to change, even for men, you know, for actresses.
Sure.
Very, very difficult time to, you know, to expand yourself compared to these days.
Mm. Or take Rock Hudson. I mean, there are a lot of people dealing with kind of fake identities in the 50s.
Oh, most certainly. So, and the other thing I was thinking about was, you know, throughout history, any time a woman is successful, what do? We diminish her to simply a sexual or insane person. And it just seems like a constant issue. I don't know, that's just what I was thinking.
No, I totally agree, and I think she's very much, the issues that she faced, I think, on the one hand, are representative. I mean, she's not an anomaly. On the other hand, they were certainly exacerbated by the 50s. There's not any question about that at all. And, you know, people like to do the speculation of what would have happened if she'd lived today, and would she be, and people do, you know, Gloria Steinem does this. So she would have been a rancher. She would have been a teacher. You know, I don't know. I think she was profoundly ambitious. And I think that she was, she clearly had a natural talent for acting. So that's always going to be a difficult profession, you know, for a woman not to be sexualized and objectified in, continues to be the case, obviously. But I think that, yeah, I think that the 50s, you know, I think that from my point of view, what happened was that she tried to make a pragmatic decision that playing the role of this bombshell would be the road to success, and it was. But then it did trap her, and I think I don't buy the whole sort of she got locked behind a mask and then she couldn't separate herself from the bombshell. She could separate herself from the bombshell. It was a role that she played. But she was typed in a very, very straightforward way, and she couldn't get out of that. And she found that incredibly frustrating and incredibly suffocating. And she simply wanted to demonstrate that she had range, that there were other things that she could do. And so I think that, yes, the 50s made that particularly difficult.
for her to find other modes. And of course, she was one of the first to try to create an independent film studio. She went about it completely the wrong way, but she was paving the way for the kinds of things that stars are doing now all the time. She was one of the people who helped bring the studio system to its knees. I mean, people don't talk about this enough, in my opinion, but in the records show that in the 1950s, two things kept 20th Century Fox afloat financially. One was CinemaScope, and the other was Marilyn Monroe.
So one of the things is the aspect of the artist and the aspect of the actress, and like this young woman said at the front, you know, it is very, very hard. Mm. It is extremely difficult. You're constantly up against your own neuroses all the time. Mm. So that doesn't mean you're insane.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. All right, we're going to take one more question. Mm-hmm. Question here.
That's where my interest on Marilyn came from, and then now I'm interested in the more therapeutic side. And I might have been confused, but a few times it seems like people, because she's held up as this example of psychoanalytical therapy and someone who's used it, and things, but I noticed a couple of times it's mentioned that failed for her. And I'm wondering, is that because eventually she died, and is that the reason, you know, is because there's so many conspiracy theories about her death, really. Mm. Is it right to say that the therapy didn't work because she committed suicide, killed by the Kennedys, however it happened?
I think you're right that the way I would frame the question is that two things have been conflated that are not necessarily related to each other, which is the question of whether she was having a successful therapeutic process that enabled her to deal with some of her mental distress and her mental suffering, and or whether that related to the idea that it failed, right, or that she failed. It seems to me always is about the fact that she died young, right? That's the failure. That's the real failure, is that she died. And one of the things I say in the book is that, you know, we're all dying. I mean, it's, you know, so is she somehow to blame for doing it sooner? I mean, what does that actually mean, you know? And so I agree with you. There's a real question there about what it is that we think that therapy would have done or was supposed to have done, and is it going to stop her from dying? But insofar as, and I disagree with Lois, I don't think the Kennedys killed her, insofar as if we believe that she died of an overdose of drugs that was self-administered, whether deliberately or by accident. If we believe that she died by her own hand, I believe that she died probably of an accidental overdose. But I don't know. I wasn't there. But if we believe that she died by her own hand, then that does raise the question of the failure of a therapeutic model to make her happy enough to either not be taking drugs recklessly and or not to seek to kill herself that night. So whether, that becomes a question, it doesn't have to be a question about deliberate suicide in order to be a question about self-destructiveness. And then there is, I think, a reasonable question to be asked about whether a therapeutic model might have been found that might have helped her not need to take chemical refuge in the way that she did. But she was not having any luck with any kinds of treatments for her addiction either, not that she particularly tried. But again, she's in an era before Betty Ford. She's in an era before, you know, those kinds of facilities were exactly, and treatments were widely available. So I think all of that kind of combined in her case.
You had your hand up at the same time. I don't know whether you want to come in with final question.
And how many similarities there are in Zanuck and Fox, colleagues, drugs, etc., but how things were so different for her and how they ended so differently. And I was also struck at the same time by how everyone calls her Marilyn.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't call Elizabeth Taylor Elizabeth.
Oh, people call her Liz all the time.
Not in this kind of discussion.
Oh, blondes and brunettes.
Yeah,
here
exactly.
We go again.
Exactly. Well, first of all, I mean... No, I agree, and I it's something that I actually did throughout the talk, because I do call her Monroe quite a lot, and I agree with you, because I think that is one of the important markers of cultural respect, and that we need to do that. And that kind of faux intimacy of calling a woman by her first name, I agree. On the other hand, it starts to become almost, to me, it becomes stiltedly formal and affected to constantly call her Monroe. I mean, that, for me, it's just a tonal question. But I agree with your with the basic point, definitely. In terms of her, in terms of thinking about her in relationship to Taylor, they were exact contemporaries. They were in the same studio working for the same boss, and they were rivals. Right, they were rivals for a magazine. They were rivals for cover stories, and they want for PR. And Taylor was one of the simplest markers of the extra degree of respect that Taylor was given was that Taylor was paid 10 times what Marilyn was paid. They, in fact, Cleopatra, Marilyn's final film, Something's Gotta Give, was shut down, and many people think she was scapegoated when she was fired because Elizabeth Taylor was busily filming Cleopatra, which was the costs were going through the roof and it was bankrupting Fox. And they shut down all productions except for Something's Gotta Give and Cleopatra. So the two really go head-to-head in professional terms at the end of Marilyn's life. You know, you can read it different ways. People say, there are people who come in and say Elizabeth Taylor deserved to make all that extra money because she was always, because she was so much more professional than Marilyn, because she always knew her lines, because she'd been working since the beginning. You can also say, though, Elizabeth Taylor had a very strong family life. She had a mother who supported her from start to finish. So, you know, there's Marilyn kind of on her own. You could even start to think about the question of, certainly in those days, about, Elizabeth Taylor and her crisp little English accent and how Daryl Zanuck would have responded to that versus Marilyn from Van Nuys, California. So all kinds of cultural influences and gender influences were no doubt at play there. I think it's impossible to go back and exactly unpick them. But it is definitely, I think, instructive, and you're not alone in thinking that that looking at them in relationship to each other, there's a lot to be seen there, although it's not exactly clear what kind of firm conclusions one can draw. My own is that Taylor was luckier than Monroe. I mean, in any sense, you know.
Sarah, I'm going to let you stop at that because I think it's been a fabulous evening. What's interesting to me is that, you know, just to turn Marilyn on herself, that we, even though she may be gone.
Talking about Zelda.
We could even talk about Zelda. No, but what's interesting, do you want to talk about Zelda a bit?
Yeah. I can, but I think everybody's ready to.
All I was going to say was that it seems to me we're still bumping into Marilyn's unconscious.
Absolutely.
Even though she's not around to tell us that.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you all very much for being here. I want to thank Sarah for being a fabulous, giving us a fabulous lecture and really giving her most to question time. And I also want to recommend this book to you, which I do think is terrific. And if you can probably only get it here for a while longer. Yeah. And I think... Is it out front or is it with you here?
I think it's here.
Sarah will sign. And thank you all for being here. And if you haven't seen the Mad Bad Sad show, there's a wonderful image of Marilyn coming out of the Bain Whitney Hospital. Moving.
And a little bit of film. I would just add also, because it's been mentioned a couple of times, the Love Marilyn documentary, which was made by Liz Garbus. And people have said it was at the London Film Festival last year. And I was lucky enough, Liz asked me to work on the film. And so I did some pieces to camera, talking head stuff in it, and I have resisted doing Marilyn stuff for a while because it seems to me that it is always so exploitative and it's always going in the same direction. And then Liz convinced me that she was going to be doing something different, and I think it's a really interesting film, and I commend it to everyone. You may not agree with all of the choices that were made, but the decision was to have lots of different actresses read snippets of Marilyn's own writings from her notebooks and her diaries, and then there are the occasional male voices coming in as a Mailer or a Miller, and it's a big list of very familiar stars who all were interested enough in the question of Marilyn as an actress that they wanted to take part in this project. So I would also recommend that to people, which I think is coming out on DVD.
Thank you, Sarah. And just because we were going to have a few questions about Zelda, but the book is out there, isn't it?
I hope so.
Yes, Julia's there with it. May sing while you buy it and sign it. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Sarah.